Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for August 5, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And it's a great thing they've got a long enough headphone cord this week. It finally reaches all the way without stretching. Physical infrastructure improving around here. We've got two guests scheduled for tonight. First, about 10 minutes after the hour, we'll speak with Frank Newport, who is the editor-in-chief of the Gallup Poll, about his new book, Polling Matters, Why Leaders Must Listen to the Wisdom of the People. But we'll also talk to him about the hot topic of the season, the election polls, and why people should believe polls at all, what they mean, and all kinds of related public opinion matters. And then at the bottom of the hour, a few minutes after, we'll speak with Tariq Ali, London-based political writer and novelist, about our presidential election, among other things. And see what Tariq meant when he said several months ago that a defeat of Bush would be regarded worldwide as a victory, and what exactly that means. And before we get to Frank Newport, some words on the economic headlines. First of all, it's one that's not out yet, but the biggie of the month, tomorrow morning, 8:30, the Bureau of Labor Statistics will announce the numbers for the July employment. That is, they do two surveys, one a survey of employers and one a survey of households. The survey of households is the source of the familiar unemployment rate and other demographic matters. But the one that most economists follow most closely is the survey of employers, which includes the big number, total employment, whether that's up or down or what, and the distribution through the various industries, the length of the work week, average hourly and weekly wages, and things like that. This is probably the single most important economic release that the U.S. government produces. It's very timely. Usually the first Friday of the month for the month preceding. So really, we're going to get a picture of July employment, and we're barely into August. It is very accurate. It's revised several times in the coming months and even the coming years, but it is still quite an accurate picture. And, of course, it's the most humanly important thing, since most people depend for their economic welfare on their jobs and their paychecks. What's happening with the state of the labor market really is the most important economic fact. So that's 8:30 tomorrow morning. Last month's number, June's number, that is, was a disappointment. We've been clocking very big gains in February, March, March, April, and May, in the 250,000, 300,000 or higher range. And the long-term average for employment growth in the United States over the last 40 or 50 years is the equivalent of about 220,000 a month. We need about, I think, close to 400,000 for the next several months for George Bush to be relieved of the title of being the first president since Hoover to preside over a decline in employment. That's not likely to happen. But there's a lot of concern among people who watch these sorts of things, or uncertainty, that is, whether the June number, which was a big disappointment at 112,000, was the beginning of some more significant slowdown in the economy and in the job market, or that was just an anomaly and we're going to kick back to the 250,000 to 300,000 range in the coming months. So this is the big question for tomorrow morning. How big was the number going to be? Most people are expecting somewhere in the neighborhood of 225,000 to 250,000. I'm expecting a bit below that. I think that while the economy is not going back into recession, it does look like it's slowing down a bit. The stimulus of the tax cuts and home equity withdrawals and all those things have been keeping the U.S. economy going for the last couple of years. Those stimuli are fading, and we're not really seeing yet the kind of vigorous job growth or vigorous corporate investment that would make the expansion more self-sustaining. So the question is, can our economy make that transition as the as we think of as the artificial stimuli of people borrowing money against their housing, or of spending their tax cuts? These stimuli are fading, and we need to see if the economy is picking up its own head of steam. And that's tomorrow's numbers will go part of the way towards answering that, but of course these things are never finally answered. So that's why you should keep tuning into this program for analysis of the numbers as they unfold. This morning, it was reported by the Department of Labor that the tally of first-time claims for unemployment insurance, that is, the people who have lost their jobs and headed over to the unemployment insurance office looking for to sign up for benefits, that fell by 11,000 last week, a little more than people expected. But the four-week moving average, which smooths out all the volatility, rose a few thousand. So it's kind of been bouncing around for the last several months at a good but not great level, and that is basically, I think, what the job market is looking like. Better, but not great. It was reported also this morning, a private survey of stores, chain stores. Their sales rose only a modest 3.1% in July. This is one of the ways that people look forward to the government's own measure of retail sales, which will be announced next week. But again, this we seem to see a slowdown in the retail sector. People had been buying things like crazy, but June and July have showed a little slowdown, and we'll see just how significant that is, whether that's another little bump on the road or this a portent of a weaker economy in the second half of this year. The Institute for Supply Management, which surveys purchasing managers, people who buy things for corporations, those indexes were released late last week and early this week. Last week for manufacturing, this week for services. The manufacturing number rose a bit to 62, a pretty good number. Anything above 50 signifies an expansion. But the number for employment fell slightly, still positive, but off slightly. And then services, a similar picture, strong number, 64.8 in the headline, but employment actually fell to 50, which is consistent with a pretty stagnant to slow-growing service sector employment. So it almost looks like we're back to that jobless pattern we saw for much of last year and early this year. So we'll see, though, when the actual tally comes out tomorrow morning. ABC News Money Magazine's weekly survey of consumer attitudes also picking up a notch last week and continuing its recovery from its swoon in April, May, and early June. So at least consumers, even though the job market's kind of iffy, consumers are still showing some enthusiasm or some optimism. And the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, which is designed to forecast turns in the economy about 6 months out, continues to decline slowly. That is further evidence that the U.S. economy is entering what some have called a soft patch. But how deep and how soft is the big question in the coming weeks. I think I'll stop there. Kind of a couple of other things here, but not really. The clock will not permit them. So let's take this musical break from Arnold Schoenberg. And then we'll be back with Frank Newport from the Gallup Poll. That was Arnold Schoenberg, so the first of six piano pieces performed by Glenn Gould. And now we're joined on the line by Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of the Gallup Poll, who is the author of a new book just published by Warner called Polling Matters, Why Leaders Must Listen to the Wisdom of the People. Welcome to WBAI, Frank Newport.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And first of all, of course, I won't be able to resist talking about the campaign season, but we'll talk about your book before we get to that great temptation. I think, well, you must know this, and you must hear this a lot. A lot of people in the general public don't really trust polls. They think they're either cooked or highly selective or highly arbitrary, a lot of people shrug their shoulders and just don't believe them. I'm not among those people, so don't worry about that. But, first of all, just give us an idea how polls are done and where the numbers that fill the headlines come from.
Well, first off, on your first comment, you're absolutely right. Interestingly, I've spent a good time here, a bit of time at Gallup, looking back at what our founder, Dr. George Gallup, faced after he first became prominent with the presidential polling in 1936. And within a few years, he was getting a large amount of criticism. People didn't believe polls, didn't understand them, didn't trust them. Books were written actually criticizing polls. The term pollster was actually a negative term, like huckster is where it came from originally. So one of the reasons I wrote the book was to just kind of follow up on Dr. Gallup, who died in 1984, and try to present to readers why I think polls are important. And in answer to your second question, how they're done, it's complex, but most polls today, the political polls that we're familiar with, national general population polls, are done by phone. And statisticians and methodologists have worked very hard over the decades to perfect methods where essentially they can assure that every residential household in America can be included in the sampling frame by using some complex procedures based on the randomly appending numbers to every known phone exchange in America. So our goal as pollsters is to have a sampling frame that lists every single possible residential number, listed or unlisted, in the country, which we can do by using phone exchanges and randomly putting numbers to them and then randomly selecting from those. And then we call that sample and complete interviews, and that's what we use.
Cell phones. A lot of people are dropping their landlines and using cell phones. Does this random technique get cell phones now?
Well, that's one of the issues that we're worried about as an industry. You know, over the years, we're constantly confronted by changes and new challenges. We are monitoring that carefully. It is of concern if huge numbers of Americans shift to cell phone only. It's a two-stage answer to your question. Usually, exchanges that just have cell phones in them are not included in our basic sampling frame. When they are, however, when a cell phone is called, we'll certainly be glad to complete the interview with that person, but most people have plans where they have to pay even if you call them on a cell phone, so they're less likely to do it. So it is an issue that we're concerned about. To date, our industry seems to indicate, the research seems to indicate, that it's not a major problem. It's still such a small number of people, relatively speaking, of the general population that are cell phone only, that we don't believe a bias is introduced into the sampling at this point. But it is an issue, along with a number of others, that telephones are changing in how they're used, and we're monitoring those and are sensitive to the implications they have.
And, of course, people are also using caller ID, and they're more selective about rejecting calls. And, it also seems that the rate of refusal to cooperate with pollsters has gone up in recent years.
That's right. There's no question about that. For a variety of reasons, one of which is just telemarketing in general, which creates a situation where people are less positive towards someone calling into the home, as well as various call screening devices, has created a lowered cooperation rate on the part of respondents nationally. There's no question about that. Ironically, the caller registration may actually help pollsters because public opinion pollsters are exempt from that. And if it does help cut down the number of telemarketers, it would help people realize that when we call, it is a legitimate call. Two points. One is, once people realize that it's a legitimate public opinion pollster like Gallup, they actually like to give their opinions. You know, that's the secret to life, Dale Carnegie told us. Ask people questions, they like to talk about themselves. So once we can get them on the line and they realize that we're asking serious questions about their opinion about, as you said, the election, Bush, Nader, Kerry, Iraq, terrorism, they like to give their opinions. And second is, we do not find as an industry, at least so far, that those lowered cooperation rates are introducing systematic bias into the process. And that's been studied extremely carefully by scientists in the survey area, academics and others. And so far, even though we have a lowered cooperation rate, the sample that we end up with, we believe, is still an unbiased representative sample of the population to which we are attempting to generalize.
Well, the one very severe test you all face is when you're predicting an election, your final poll a couple of days before the election, and then how do those compare with the actual election results? There's been really no deterioration in accuracy in recent years, has there?
That's right. George Gallup used to say one of the reasons he did. By the way, pre-election polling is a hazardous profession. You know, we learned that this week when we came out and said after the Democratic Convention, we did not see that Kerry had enjoyed the kind of uptick in the polling that usually candidates get. I mean, we got a fusillade of negative commentary from Democrats and others who said it should be. But had we shown the opposite in that Kerry had gained 30 points, then the Republicans would have criticized as heavily as pollsters. And so it's a hazardous profession to be out there before an election because people feel so strongly about it. But your point is well taken that polling before an election gives us a good test. And it's quite accurate. Generally, if you look at all the polls done in major elections and others, it's remarkably how accurate if small samples can predict what millions do the next day.
Well, that's one of the questions that a lot of people have is, your sample is maybe 1,000, 1,200 people. How can that predict the behavior of 100 or 200 million people?
Well, when you go to the doctor to get your cholesterol checked, does he drain all the blood out of your body?
I hope not. That would be rather Dracula-like of him.
He takes a sample, and that seems to work well. You know, when we're this is one of George Gallup's great analogies. When we're making soup, big vat of soup, we don't have to consume the entire vat to see if it's too salty. You know, we stir it up and take a sample. The idea holds that if done well, small samples can allow you to generalize to the large population. If you're at a lake and you're an environmental scientist, you don't have to test every last drop of water in the lake. You take random samples of the water around the lake, and then you can look at the bacteria levels, and you're pretty sure you can generalize to the entire lake. And it's the same idea. If correctly sampled, and that's the key, if chosen correctly, relatively small samples like drops of blood or samples from a lake can allow you to generalize to the entire group of people.
I'm speaking with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll, author of the book Polling Matters, Why Leaders Must Listen to the Wisdom of the People, just published by Warner Books. And before we get to some of the more current polls. One of your points in this book is that politicians should listen to polls. I mean, there's certainly this idea out there that they should be bold and indifferent to listening to the polls is almost considered a critique in some circles.
Mm-hmm.
You're arguing that almost this is a kind of real-time plebiscite, a lot of policy matters that people should listen to more carefully.
Yeah, we've gotten far out of kilter. Two points there. Hitler and Mussolini, among others, echoed the sentiment you just said there. We need bold leaders who take creative steps on their own and don't listen to the people. You know, that's been the rallying cry behind dictators throughout history, that they know more than the people. The second point is that we have indeed gotten to a situation now where it seems to be pejorative to some politicians and others to say, oh, he just listens to the polls. I like to substitute people for the word polls. So if somebody says you shouldn't listen to the polls, you're really saying you shouldn't listen to the people. And that scares me. You know, I hearken back to the good old days when the reason we sent off representatives to the state capitol and to Washington was because we couldn't all be there at once. So we said, you know, Doug, you go off this year, represent us. And next year, you're too busy farming, so I'll go next year. Each year we would just send somebody off to try to do his or her best job of representing us. I think we've gotten out of kilter now with this whole idea that we send these people off and they become geniuses overnight when we send them off. We can't have direct democracy, I don't believe. I'm not advocating that we do away with representatives. I think we need them in a complex society. But I do believe there is great wisdom in the collective views of the people. Great wisdom in the collective views of the people. Polling's the way to measure it. And anybody making decisions about our country and our future should pay attention to that wisdom.
Let's get to the present then, and talk about some of the polls in the present moment. You alluded to one earlier, the lack of bounce from Kerry, from the Democratic convention in Kerry's numbers, at least as revealed by the Gallup poll. Other polls showed a little bit more of a bounce than yours did. First of all, why do you think Gallup has been showing slightly different results from, say, the ABC Washington Post poll, which showed more of a bounce?
Well, first of all, there are not big differences between these polls. People are kind of looking with a microscope and doubling the apparent change by looking at the margin rather than the single percentages. And if you look at them, there are differences, like a Newsweek poll that was presented. Half the interviews were done Thursday night, even before Kerry's speech, so it's not really a bounce poll. Other polls, the CBS poll, showed no change pre and post in the percent of the vote that Kerry had or Bush had. A Marist Institute poll out today showed no change in the percent of the vote pre and post. ABC poll showed some change, but if you go back before the convention, they, unlike other polls, had Bush up at that point. So now that they show Kerry up slightly, it's a bigger apparent change. My point is, if you look across all these polls, allow for margin of error, you really see they're all showing roughly the same. Not a lot of major change, and the race is really too close to call. you know, one poll may have Bush up by a couple of points, another one has Kerry up by a couple of points, but they're all showing basically the same thing. So the apparent, and this is usually true, not always, that when there look like there are big differences between polls, they're usually not. Well-done national polls typically are picking up the same general ideas, and I think that's the case right now. Almost every poll that I've looked at shows the race still remains very close in terms of the popular vote.
And Reed Teixeira, the Century Fund, who's been on this show many times, writes a weekly memo on public opinion, has pointed out several times that Gallup's approval rating for George Bush has been usually a bit higher than the other polls. Any idea why that might be?
I don't believe that's fair. I think that we had a scholarly paper presented, for example, at the American Association of Public Opinion Research that I was at, session, you know, this May, which was held out in Phoenix. And the data did not seem to suggest that there was any strong differences between, you know, most, some, but particularly not Gallup's compared to the other polls. So I don't think there's empirical evidence to show that there's some kind of systematic tendency where one poll is always different than the others in terms of approval ratings. There are differences, slight differences, in the way people ask questions and have methodological assumptions that they build into their polls, which sometimes does account for some differences. You know, we at Gallup believe that we do it extremely well. We've been working on it since 1935. Our techniques, the methodology, we have PhDs that do nothing but kind of scrutinize our methodology. You know, this is the fourth election that I've been through extraordinarily closely monitoring how we measure it, and we do more frequent polling, and I hope that we can say we do it as well as anything else. So although there's some small differences, I, of course, would say I have a great confidence in what we present.
And let's talk about some of the unusual features of this election. First of all, the amount of undecided voters is very small, as has been widely noted. Does that make your work any more complicated?
Well, technically, it's not the amount of undecideds that are smaller, because undecideds in our nomenclature are those whom, after you ask, even do you lean for a candidate, refuse to give you an answer. And that's small, but it's usually small, you know, 5% or less. So what we find that is actually smaller is what I call swing voters. That is, even if you make a choice, we follow up and say, is there some way you might vote for the other candidate? And the people willing to admit they might change their mind is smaller. So the general point is well taken. It is accurate, I believe, based on our Gallup research, that there are fewer voters in play this year, at least from what they tell us. That doesn't necessarily make our work more difficult. In some ways, it's a little easier because we have this kind of remarkable stability in our numbers. You know, poll to poll to poll to poll, we're not seeing a lot of change this year, and I think that's part of the reason. It also may be one of the explanations for why there were not dramatic changes after the Democratic Convention. People are more fixed already. They're paying a lot of attention. So even though they may have watched the convention, since they've already been paying attention, they already were exposed to Kerry and Edwards, and there wasn't a lot new that came out of the convention. Whereas in previous years, if you're kind of not paying much attention, the convention could be the first time you really focus. And that may be one reason you get the bounce. You say, oh, well, now that I see Kerry and Edwards, I like them. This year, everybody already knows the players.
And as I recall, you wrote in one of the Tuesday briefings that that was likely to happen.
Yeah, I think we're looking ahead of time, even before this convention, said it wouldn't be surprising to find that there was less of a significant change after the conventions. Now, it's going to be interesting to see the New York GOP convention, but if that theory holds, we shouldn't see much of a change after that for Bush either. Now, Bush skyrockets after the Republican convention, and Kerry didn't. Then it does suggest that one of the explanations for the lack of a Democratic bounce is that the voters were not overwhelmed by Kerry and Edwards. You know, a straightforward explanation. But it's a little early to tell. We're going to have to monitor that and see. Certainly it would be a reasonable hypothesis that we're not going to see a lot of change after the Republican convention either, unless they happen to find Osama bin Laden in the Tuesday of the convention or something like that.
And I've heard some people speculating that there may be people who are new voters who are much more passionately, say, anti-Bush and more likely to vote than they would have been in previous years. And your projections, your algorithms you use to project who's likely to vote may not capture that. Is there any truth to that?
Well, that's the Michael Moore thesis. I say that because apparently he went on some TV show recently and made that point. I think a lot of us have respect for Michael Moore's courage, that he goes out and is willing to take strong stances, and also have, I personally have respect for his ability as a brilliant documentary filmmaker, but I certainly am not well acquainted with his credentials as a pollster and public opinion scientist, so I'm not sure that his critiques of polling along those lines are well-founded in the data, because they're not. We've been doing this for a long time. We're not dummies. If there is, we're prepared. We know how to look for it. If there's some influx of huge numbers of new young voters that look like they're going to be voting for the first time in for Kerry, we would pick that up. We, for example, report all voters. We just had an article on the Gallup.com website yesterday which showed the data among every single national adult. And then we showed it among registered voters and then our likely voter model. So we present to the user of our data various assumptions. And if this thesis is correct, when you look at registered voters or all voters, you're more likely to see the giant surge. And they are a little less Republican, no question about that, and that's typically the case. But we haven't seen any giant surge yet. But we'll monitor it. We monitor it carefully. We're looking for that. I think we will pick it up if, in fact, that's the case.
And I remember reading some articles in the political science literature several years ago arguing that U.S. presidential elections are actually quite predictable if you take some data from the second quarter of the year, particularly like the president's approval rating and income growth over the previous year. You can predict elections fairly accurately, and all the bouncing around the polls do in the summer and the fall it's just so much noise, and people will come back to what was kind of baked in the cake in the previous spring. Is there any truth to that in your experience?
Well, 2 points. One is I'm not an expert on those models. You know, I study public opinion for a living, and I don't study a lot of these economic models, so I really don't know to what degree we can say they've been accurate. But I've certainly been exposed to some that in 2000 strongly, you know, economists and others looked at all the data and said Gore should win strongly. And, of course, he didn't. Well, he won the popular vote, but he certainly didn't overwhelmingly win even the popular vote and, of course, didn't win the Electoral College after the Supreme Court decision. So I'm not sure that that improves that those models work. But I don't know. Those are, you know, that would probably be questions to ask another guest. I just don't follow those carefully.
And, of course, the economists do those sorts of things now are predicting a landslide for Bush, particularly Ray Fair at Yale.
Yeah, I've seen that. I can, you know, we look at the polling data. And I can say, looking at the historical context for polling data against previous elections with an incumbent, that we don't see that Bush is going to be a landslide winner. He's certainly not tracking, as we've pointed out many times, the trajectory of winning incumbents. Clinton in 96, Reagan in 84, Nixon in 72, Johnson in 64, Dwight Eisenhower in 56, those are the last five incumbents who won. All of them were tracking much better than Bush during this year. Their job approvals were higher. They were above their opponents most of the time in the trial heat balloting. Bush has been behind Kerry, and Bush's job approval still to this day remains under 50%. So that doesn't suggest to me, based on history, that he's going to be, you know, landslide George, kind of like Nixon was in 72. It looks like he's vulnerable. He's not as bad off as his father or Carter, who lost, obviously, in 92 and in 1980, respectively, but he's certainly not doing extremely well. So at least based on our historical analysis, I think that Bush is in a gray zone where he's not tracking to look very good. He's not tracking like he's a disaster, and that's one reason that I continue to say, as of today, it's an extremely close race.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. Frank Newport, who is the editor-in-chief of the Gallup Poll and author of Polling Matters, Why Leaders Must Listen to the Wisdom of the People, and we'll be back after this break.
Hi, this is Alec Baldwin, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Anything can happen.
Support WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
Anything can happen. Anything can happen.
Alec Baldwin, well, the man that page 6 of the Post calls the Bloviator, doing a station ID for us. How flattering. This is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News, and we'll be back with Tariq Ali after another word from Glenn Gould playing Arnold Schoenberg. And that, the fourth of Arnold Schoenberg's Piano Suites, Opus 23, performed by Glenn Gould. And this is Doug Henwood, the program Behind the News, and now we're joined on the line by Tarek Ali, who has been graciously stayed up to join us at what is a very late hour in London. Welcome to WBAI, Tarek.
Hi there, Doug. Good to be with you.
So I wish I could have the title of your latest book on the tip of my tongue, but I don't, so why don't you...
It's Bush in Babylon, the recolonization of Iraq, but Bush in Babylon is the key.
Okay, well, or Mesopotamia, as the Daily Show calls it.
Yeah.
So first of all, let's talk about Bush. You said some months ago when you were debating Gideon Rose here in New York, Gideon Rose of Foreign Affairs magazine, that a defeat of Bush would be greeted worldwide as a victory. What did you mean by that exactly?
Well, Doug, as you know, I mean, I travel a great deal, all the continents, and I think everywhere I go, there is growing anger, and if one can just be totally blunt, real hatred of this administration because of what it did in Iraq. The war it waged, the civilians it killed, the mess it's made, and its inability to understand even the scale of what it's done. And from that point of view, if the American population were to vote Bush out of office, I think the impact globally would be tremendous for the following reasons. People would say, this guy took his country to war, surrounded by these neocons who developed bogus arguments and lies to go to war against Iraq. He lied to his people, he misused intelligence information, and the American people have voted him out. That in itself, I think, would have a tremendous impact on world public opinion. Apart from anything else, people like me travel around the world and say, look, you can attack the United States, the regime, what it does, but the American people are different. There is an anti-war movement in the States. There are lots of people who don't like what Bush is doing. And people, especially in parts of the Arab world and Latin America, find this difficult to believe. So from that point of view, a defeat for a warmonger government in Washington would be seen as a step forward. I don't go beyond that, but there is no doubt in my mind that it would have an impact globally.
Now, of course, a lot of people on the American left in particular, such as it is, are saying that Kerry's not much better, that Bush is really pretty much the same old thing, that he's an imperialist and a warmonger just like all his predecessors, and there's not all that much difference. And, you know, Kerry, who opened his acceptance speech with a military salute, it would be just pretty much more the same. What do you say to that?
Well, we're talking about the government which took the United States to war, Doug. This is the government which decided to make war in Iraq. It's an open question to me. I know this is argument goes on. If Gore had been elected president, would he? He would have probably gone to war in Afghanistan if 9/11 had happened. But I doubt, personally, I doubt whether he would have gone to war in Iraq. This is very much a neocon agenda dominated by the need to both get the oil, as we know, but also to appease the Israelis, who've been very keen on this war. So this particular war in Iraq is very much something this particular administration went for. So for the defeat of this administration would be a defeat of the war party. Now, what will Kerry do? The thing is, he probably will not do good things immediately, but I think everything is to be gained from changing the regime, having a regime change in Washington, and then putting massive pressure on Kerry to pull the troops out. And I think, you know, it's not going to be easy, but for God's sake, it'll be a much better relationship of forces if Bush is voted out. Let's assume that Kerry is the most opportunist, foolish, weak, etc., etc. If that is the case, which it may well be, probably is, then he will. It will have some impact on him because he will know that the reason Bush has been voted out is largely because of this war. So I mean, there is an argument which is also doing the rounds on the American left, which I read, which is the following. It goes like this. It says, yeah, but Bush has, you know, really united the world against the United States Empire, and that's a good thing. But, you know, I do not like arguments like that for the following reasons. That this is an argument you can have from the luxury of your sitting room or kitchen in the United States. But the fact is that this particular regime has taken the lives of at least 37,000 civilians in Iraq as a result of the war, not counting any members in the old army of Iraq. 37,000 civilians have died, and for them it's not an abstract question as to whether this war was waged or not. So a defeat for Bush would certainly be greeted in many parts of the world as a small victory. This doesn't mean that one has any illusions about Kerry. I certainly don't. And if I'm honest with you, I'm pretty disgusted by the militarism at the Democrat Convention. I mean, this notion that the Vietnam War was good, and Clinton's Michael Moore moment, you know, send me, which should be in a future Michael Moore documentary, was grotesque. But despite all that, and we know what the Democrats are, and we know what the wars they've waged, our option at the moment is limited. Do we defeat a warmonger government or not? Do we try our best to do it? If Kerry goes on the same way, we just have to fight him. So what? You know, we've been doing this all the time.
I'm speaking with Tariq Ali, the London-based political analyst and novelist, and prolific in all genres, and author most recently of Bush in Babylon. Now, there are a lot of people who will argue that the personnel don't really matter, that something like the war in Iraq emerge from the inner mechanisms of American capitalism, American imperialism, that, you know, the rate of profit or the oil price or something that sort of forced the hand, and whoever's sitting in the Oval Office is really just a pawn of larger forces. Do you buy that kind of analysis?
Well, I don't buy that, because, you know, if you believe that that's all there is to it, Doug, then you can just give up politics. You know, just wait at home and see till, wait for the big catastrophe or whatever horror you think is going to happen sooner or later. This is not the way in which you can try and mobilize public opinion and engage in debates to win people over. That sort of argument, for me, is a dead argument, because it means you don't have to win people over. The only way you can win people to your arguments is you go out into the streets, you argue, you talk, and I think there is a lot to be done at the present time. And my own feeling is that a defeat for Bush would create a different atmosphere, let's say in American political culture, to show it can be done. And it will make people much more critical, so that I think that the honeymoon period with Kerry, unlike that with Clinton, will be very limited. Because whatever Kerry says now, most people who vote for him will, including large chunks of actual Democratic Party supporters, will do so because they don't like what Bush has done in Iraq. They don't like the way the economy is handled. They don't like the way the environment is being dealt with. They will not vote for any other reasons against Bush. So when Kerry is in power, and if he carries on in the same way, I think it'll be much, much easier to build a much bigger movement against him. That's my feeling.
Now, when you you travel around, talk to a lot of people, how do they perceive what's driving the United States? Do they see Bush as some sort of representative of the American population, the American character, or is he some kind of bizarre usurper who came in and stole the election?
Well, I think the usurper feeling view is largely in the United States. The rest of the world, there is a bit of that in Europe too, but in Africa, in Latin America, in the Arab world, they don't see it like that. They see Bush as a particularly unintelligent president, surrounded by quite sharp and intelligent people who are regarded as very sinister and dangerous because they pushed him into the war in Iraq, occupying a sovereign independent Arab state which was not a threat to anyone, neither its neighbors nor, leave alone, the United States or Britain. And they try and understand why this happened. And there's a big debate that goes on about this all over the world. And they see Bush as a very adventurous, as a very aggressive defender of American imperial power. And some also see him as irrational defender of American power, because a more rational defender of American power would not have done it in the same way. So these debates, of course, go on. But there's no doubt, and the other thing, Doug, which disturbs people a great deal, is the religious fundamentalism in the White House. I mean, when people sometimes hear the American president talking about his links with the divine being and how that has played a very important part in his decision-making, or when they hear about Ashcroft and Ashcroft singing hymns, I mean, you've got to understand that 9/11, the things which chilled people were the images of Bush and Ashcroft. And this is a film which has been shown on Cuban television. It's going to be shown this coming week, I think, on Venezuelan television. Clandestine DVDs and videos of 9/11 are circulating all over the world. And so it reinforces what people have been thinking from that point of view. And I think that the mood is a very angry one. Now, when I talk to people and they say to me, you know, when I'm in Caracas or Cairo or Beirut, what do you think of Kerry? And I am honest. I think I don't think he's great. I don't think he is a very strong political leader. I don't think he's a very gifted politician, but he's the guy the Democrats have chosen, and if Bush is going to be defeated, he's the one who's going to get in. He's the one the American people will have to deal with, and you guys will have to deal with, and I advise you not to have any illusions. But the argument for which I have very little sympathy is the worse it gets, the better. This is a dangerous argument. Doug, and I, you know, this is an argument one has heard a long time ago in the 30s of the last century in Europe. The let Hitler come to power. I'm not saying, you know, remotely that that's what the Republicans are like. I'm just attacking this argument that the worse it gets, the better the chance for the left, and that is never the case.
Yes,
it never happens.
After Hitler, us, right? Was the
well,
was
exactly.
The yeah.
Exactly. And that isn't the case. And I think one has to be very realistic. You needn't have any illusions in the Democrats at all, like I don't. But still, I believe it would be a good thing globally and within the United States if Bush were defeated. It would change the relationship of forces, and it would then mean that if Kerry is carrying on in the same way, there's no excuses at all. It's hardly likely that people will then be banking on the Republicans to come to their rescue. So they will have to act in a different way too. So from every point of view, I think it is important that the Republicans are defeated in this election. I think from that point of view, it's an important election. And I think, I mean, I hear I must confess that a defeat for Bush would be very helpful in Britain, because the Blair gang in power in London are scared out of their wits. They're backing Bush. They hope he won't be defeated, because Blair knows if Bush goes, he'll go too.
But there isn't much of an alternative to Blair at this point.
Well,
there?
This is exactly the same problem, but the people in the by-elections have been voting for the Liberals, who were certainly against the war, unlike the Democrats. The Liberal Democratic Party in the House of Commons did not vote for the war. And there are about 80 Labour members of Parliament who voted against the war. So what I say when I'm asked is, vote for the 80 Labour members of Parliament who voted against the war, and where you're confronted with a pro-war Labour Party guy against a Lib Dem who's opposed the war, a party opposed the war, vote Lib Dem. I mean, I think to defeat all the warmongers, the Spanish have done it first. If the Americans were to do it, it'd be tremendous and could lead to the defeat of Blair in Britain and Berlusconi in Italy. And that would be tremendous news for Europe.
And let's take a look at Iraq now. Of course, I'm sure it's been no surprise to you how disastrously the invasion turned out. What do you think of the present situation? What's going to unfold?
Well, Doug, there are two things basically going on in Iraq. The first thing is, let's forget the old lies they told. Now we're being told a new set of lies, which is quite shocking that the Western media, predominantly in the United States and Britain, which should have learned the lessons from the past of just a year ago of not accepting government propaganda, are now actually pretending that the government we have in Iraq is an independent government. I mean, this is a complete farce and a joke. It's like the government set up during the occupation of Europe by the Germans during the Second World War. It's absolutely no different in its structure. The guy who makes all the key decisions in Baghdad is not this old CIA thug, Alawi, but John Negroponte, the Reaganite purveyor of violence in Central America, who now basically sits in the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad and makes all the key decisions. The British ambassador used to do it when the Brits governed Iraq in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and the United States are doing it now. And the thing is, no one in the Arab world thinks it's otherwise. So, till there is an independent government there, this is going to carry on. And the news today from Najaf, which is there were pitched battles between the supporters of Muqtada al-Sadr and the United States. He's called for open resistance. A U.S. helicopter was shot down. This is not going to get any better. If anything, it's going to get worse. And all those people who defended this war saying, oh, at least we've got rid of a dictator. Well, yeah, that's true. But the situation you've actually created now is much, much worse than it was at least for the last 10 years of the dictatorship. That is recognized today by people in Iraq who loathed and despised Saddam Hussein are saying things are much worse. So it's a critical situation for the United States. And I think the Republicans are hoping that nothing big will happen before now in the election, which is why they're creating these false alarms based on 2 years old intelligence, which the Pakistani military have got them, in trying to frighten the American population into saying, look, we're still under threat, but actually trying to divert attention away from the big mess which they've created in Iraq. I mean, there's absolutely no reason for these poor American kids serving in the army to be there. They shouldn't be there. No one should be being killed. Bush is responsible for that. And I think the situation in Iraq is not going to get better at all. It's going to get worse and worse. And no, they should have learned from what the Brits did. The Brits, who were much, much cleverer in running that country, finally couldn't do it. And the same thing is happening now.
Yeah, are the Americans capable of being proper imperialists, or are they just too provincial and insulated to handle the job?
They are not good at running countries directly, and that's why they've understood that this is not a strong point and have preferred to run a country through local relays. They did it in Latin America through a whole set of military dictators for a long time. They're doing it in Pakistan today via the military. From their point of view, the best way to have run Iraq, but they didn't do this, was to have, if they wanted to totally control the regime, was to have got rid of Saddam in the top and done deals with the Iraqi generals and then put them in power. That's the way they would have got what they wanted, but they decided instead to go on to do this massive exercise of direct occupation, and that's a disaster. They're no good at it, and they know that perfectly well, and which is why there's talk even with, I mean, I the other day, and not the other day, a few months ago, I was in Australia debating Daniel Pipes. And to my astonishment, he agreed that the American soldiers should all be pulled out. He said it's a disaster, it's gone hopelessly wrong. And when the interviewer tried to get him and me to argue by asking me how I would characterize this new Iraqi government, I said it's a puppet regime regarded as such by its country. And Pipe said, well, I don't agree with the way he says it, but basically it's true.
I'm speaking with Tariq Ali, author most recently of Bush in Babylon, and time is running short, many things to cover. Just you did mention Pakistan, and that's an interesting topic in itself. But on the one hand, we saw the Bush administration pressuring the Pakistanis to come up with some high-value targets, as they call them, in time for the Democratic Convention. Yeah. On the other hand, we see continuing reports of complicity with the Taliban among at least portions of the Pakistani government. What's going on in Pakistan?
Well, basically what's going on there, Doug, in Afghanistan, is that, as some of us predicted, putting a puppet government in place in Afghanistan with Hamid Karzai and Khalilzad as the U.S. consul in the region doesn't win you support. Without the presence of U.S. soldiers and Western soldiers there, this regime would fall. And now they've realized they need to win local support. All their old allies from the Northern Alliance are not playing ball with them. So they've started discussing with a section of the Taliban, courtesy of the Pakistan Army, saying perhaps we can do a deal with a section of the Taliban which wasn't linked to Osama bin Laden. Well, maybe they know which section wasn't linked to him and which was, but no one else does. So they've opened their secret talks going on in Afghanistan between the United States and the Taliban today by this Bush regime, which said this is the worst regime in the world. Mrs. Bush and Mrs. Blair went on television and said they were fighting for women's liberation. Big joke, that. And the Pakistani military is trying to help them sort something out there, but it's not working. It is not working, and it's an open question whether the Pakistanis will be able to do it, because their own country is pretty destabilized by all this. There have been three attempts on Musharraf's life. The guy who wants to be the new prime minister was nearly knocked off 48 hours ago, so they're not in a stable situation.
Yeah, what is the longevity of the Musharraf government?
Well, I think that the longevity of this government depends on how long he survives. The last two attempts came very close to getting him, and we know now that his travel route was revealed to the terrorist group which tried to knock him off by people within his own bodyguard. Now, if that is the situation, that you cannot trust anyone within your own armed forces, well, then it's just a question of time.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Tariq Ali, who is author most recently of Bush in Babylon, prolific political analyst and novelist, joining us at a late hour from London. Thanks, Tariq, and that's it for
very
me.
Very good, Doug.
That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back next week. Among the guests will be Bob McChesney, talking about his latest book on the media, and it was a popular topic, and it was a popular guest. That's it for tonight. Let's go out with this, another of Schoenberg's piano pieces, number 5 of the Piano Suite, Opus 23, again performed by Glenn Gould. Till next week, goodbye.